What are Tinkers and Reeves?
They're things that got made up. Tinkers are a kind of a catch-all name for this group of sort of scientist magicians. They do alchemy, which is this kind of magical version of chemistry that's based sort of on history and a lot on what people sort of thought about it years and years and years ago. We'll get to Reeves in a second, right? But what Tinkers do is they basically use their own personal mojo to push the laws of chemistry, right? So what that would do is you could use that to turn the floor that we're sitting on into liquid and drop us through it. Or you could change the air around somebody into like a cocoon to kind of grab them or bop them on the head or something like that, right? And the Reeve are essentially these kind of almost like a kind of a secret police of England. They spy on people and they take their obligation to the crown really, really seriously. So I think of them sort of like special operations.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. Our funding comes from members of Montana Public Radio and from Humanities Montana. I'm Cherie Newman, and I'm talking with Kent Davis today about books 1 and 2 in his series titled A Riddle in Ruby. The action in A Riddle in Ruby series, books 1 and 2 anyway, because 3 hasn't been published yet.
It has not.
Takes place in colonial America, back when a British king ruled the country and all that. But this is not the version we learned in our history books, what you've written in these novels. In fact, in an online interview, you describe these books as, here we go, steampunk alt-historical colonial America with a side of alchemy adventure fantasy. So that's a new genre on me.
No, it's very small. It's niche. it's definitely not, I'd say, historical. I did a lot of research when I started really thinking about the world, and I still do a lot of research to try to get a kind of an authentic feel to things. But most of the research is thrown out the window in favor of the way that I want it to possibly have happened. So yeah, it's definitely not, it's alternate history, I'd say, with magic and all those other adjectives.
Well, you have a girl, a 13-year-old girl mm-hmm. named Ruby Teach as your protagonist, and a lot of people are after Ruby. So tell us who she is and why everybody wants her.
Well, Ruby is, she's an apprentice thief, and her father is a fake pirate. So the reimagined history puts the colonies forward by about 100 years technologically into like a kind of an industrial revolution. And what Ruby's dad does, her dad's name is Waylon Teach, is he basically carts people up and down the eastern seaboard on a kind of a pirate cruise ship, getting them from place to place and presenting sort of pirate shows for them and things like that. So he's a scam artist. And Ruby has kind of taken on that kind of idea with the help of a mentor of hers, and she's learning to become a thief. When we meet her, she's getting ready to try to essentially be promoted into kind of the ranks of more official thieves. But she's already outside of society, right? Partially, she's defined as what she's not. She's not part of the status quo. She's not a princess in a tower. She's not someone who is essentially destined for greatness, right? She's courageous and a little bit flawed, and people are running around chasing her because of a secret that her mom, who is also a tinker, also a chemist, right, kind of wove into her blood. So the reason why she's being chased is because of who her parents are, who her people are, but it's not necessarily because of anything she's done. So one of the reasons I like that sort of idea for Ruby is I've never been a fan of chosen one narratives, right? Where there's a prophecy about you and you're going to unite the kingdom and it's all going to be amazing. I'm much more attracted to characters who are scrabbling really hard and trying to figure out who they are as they're going through their adventures. And so all of those things sort of went into Ruby's, I guess, essence. She's flawed and she's scared some of the time and she makes really, really amazingly huge mistakes. And then she learns from them. And she cares deeply and fiercely about the people around her. And she's trying to figure out sort of, you know, as a 13-year-old, one of the most important things to me was figuring out who I was. And so I really tried to weave that sort of idea into these books too, as well as having them be, you know, rip-roaring adventures and have lots of crazy chase scenes and things like that.
They are very rip-roaring. Well, in the first book, Ruby and her father, as you said, are living this piratey kind of life, but a faux pirate life. And they've taken on two passengers named Lord Athan and his servant Cram. And I'd like you to read the passage in which Ruby's father discovers that they're being chased.
Sure.
It starts on page 54.
I am happy to. She found her father at the stern with Skillet. The little man had relinquished his place at the wheel and was grimly sharpening the edges of his namesake, a heavy cast-iron pan that he wielded two-handed. Her father told a story about his killing a Portuguese admiral with that thing. Ruby had only seen him cook bacon in it. Waylon Teach was looking astern through his eyepiece, a marvel of tinkercraft. There was some sort of watery stuff inside, and the green metal housing heated and pulsed when you held it up to your eye. It could see twice as far as the finest spyglass. He was uncharacteristically silent. He stood there for a long while, and the deck was still. Skillet's whetstone kept time with the wind. The entire crew was shoulder to shoulder on the main deck, staring up at them, bristling with the oddest collection of weaponry Ruby had ever seen. Gwath was there, with a pair of wicked-looking kitchen cleavers. Mock had what looked to be a sharpened parasol. Paul the Gizzard had a sledgehammer studded with stones, and Frog Jerky wielded a huge haunch of swine. They looked comfortable, alert, and 12 times more dangerous than the band of harmless and good-natured scalawags that she had thought manned her father's ship. Lord Athan and Cram were standing to one side, the serving boy taking long, loving looks at the lifeboat. Athan sketched a bow to her across the deck. Big Shim and Little Shim, the carpenters, were pulling apart a barrel on the starboard side and assembling a hidden machine from its insides. Ruby leaned over and asked Skillet, "Is that a cannon?" He winked. Captain Teach cursed under his breath and dropped the eyepiece. The crew watched as he cleared his throat. "They may have found us, men," he said, and there was no trace of pirate in his tone. "It's flying Royal Navy colors, a black kraken of metal and chem. A tinker ship coming after us at full tilt, fair dancing across the waves." Skillet's whetstone stopped. No one spoke. Lord Athan called from his place by the rail. "Captain, I think they may seek me." Cram looked at the lordling as if he'd just grown another head. The crew craned their necks around to stare as if it were a lawn tennis match. The waves and wind dominated the conversation. "Why would you say that, young sir?" Her father's tone somehow genially cut glass. "Well, Captain, I did say I was in a touch of a hurry to reach Philadelphia." "Indeed, sir, but you did not deign to tell us that the undue haste was in anticipation of hot pursuit by the King of England's Admiralty." The glass cutter was no longer genial. "I was unsure of the response to my exit from London. It was possible I left unnoticed. Possible, but not likely, given the 2,000 tons of doom bearing down on the Thrift that will catch us within the hour. Can you tell me why I shouldn't just lower sail, let them approach us, and turn you over?" "Perhaps they are searching for you." "Explain yourself." Athan reached down to his belt. 20 dangerous men raised knives, pans, tools, sharpened umbrellas, and a heavy hog's leg. Athan raised a letter sealed with wax. "I had thought to give you this when we arrived in Philadelphia. I do not know the entirety of its contents, but I was told to give it to you if circumstances warranted. Paul, Teach snapped, and the skinny mate shouldered the sledge, snatched the letter from the gentleman's hand, and hurried it up to the captain. The captain handed the eyepiece to Skillet, broke the seal, and read it. He became very still. Your letter is persuasive, sir. Athen bowed. I am glad it proved effective. Oh, indeed, Teach replied. Effective enough to compel me and my family to unprecedented action. I warn you, however, we compel effectively, but not happily. Lord Athen's lips curved into a thin smile. I have never been taught that a tool should feel anything toward its master. A deaf man could have heard a pin drop. In fact, Mock dropped his teeth, the wooden ones right out of his open gums. They clattered onto the deck in the silence. Teach fingered his cutlass. Perhaps, boy, if we all see the end of this day, I might offer you a moment of instruction in the manipulation of tools. I am at your service, Captain. Do we run or fight, Captain? Skillet rasped from the wheel. They'll be on us in two snaps. The speck to the east was growing with alarming speed. Teach looked at Ruby for a moment, face unreadable. Neither, he said. We keep on as usual. I won't throw away 13 years of hiding in plain sight for a hunch. Crew, about your business. Lord Athen, a word. As the crew sprang into action, Teach turned to his daughter. Ruby interrupted before he could speak. What is happening? She demanded. Ruby, listen to me. I won't until you tell me there's no time, Poppet. He put a hand on her shoulder, pulling his beard on with the other. An enemy may be upon us. What did we do to make England angry? He ignored the question. You need to go down to your hidey hole that you think I don't know about and wall yourself in. Athen had taken the steps to the forecastle two at a time, and Teach handed him the letter. Captain, I fear they may be accompanied by members of the Reeve, Athen said. Teach looked to the heavens as if for guidance. Who? Ruby asked. Special agents of the Crown, my dear. They are formidable. Teach turned to Athen. You, sir, and your servant, please accompany my daughter. She is taking you to a safe place. Be silent as a tomb and open for no one, even for me. Only come out if you hear Skillet ring that the coast is clear. He crushed her in a bear hug. She found herself clinging to him as well. Bring your knives. You may have need of them.
You've been listening to Kent Davis read from book one of his A Riddle in Ruby series of fantasy adventure novels for young readers. This is The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. If you just joined us, you can hear what you missed online. MTPR is the place to listen on demand. You can also sign up for our podcast there. Once again, we're online at mtpr.org. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter. So there are several secret societies operating behind the scenes, and I love the names you gave them.
Thank you.
So tell us what they are.
Okay. Well, certainly you've met the Reeve. One of the most important that have a wide global sort of level of influence and truly, truly sort of deep and serious impact on world events are called the Worshipful Order of Grocers, which is one of the things that I think is really important with kids and also, frankly, with adults is I think that the way to open up someone to actually be sort of affected by something that you're making is by using humor. So I really constantly sort of look for ways to kind of surprise or allow people a moment to have a laugh and maybe not take everything so seriously. I don't know if that's, you know, important right now in the times we're living in.
But, always.
but yeah, so the Worshipful Order of Grocers, their symbol is a camel. It's very, very ferocious. And basically they sort of hide behind this idea of being spice merchants and grocers so that they can pass, you know, unseen amongst the hoi polloi. And so there's the Worshipful Order, and then there's also a kind of American colonial cousin of theirs called the Blue Stockings, which is actually based on a group of people that were pretty intense readers back in colonial America.
There's one that oversees some of the others, and I liked their name too.
Yeah, the Pepper Clerks. And that's actually, they're watchers within the watchers. So they're keeping track of the grocers and keeping tabs on them. Yeah, and so there's layers within layers within layers, and it's all very, very intricate and sometimes approaches levels of ridiculousness, but hopefully that's just in the name of fun as well.
I had fun being immersed in the story, but somewhere in my mind I was thinking, how is he keeping track of all this?
Yeah, I have a massive kind of, it's actually a Bible of details about characters and also the whole setting of the world, and also the you know, the rules of chemistry and the settings, and also certainly the events, because I think one of the things that's really helpful for a book like this is to try to put the characters inside of a series of events that may or may not happen due to their influence. But I think to be able to do that, you need to know the sort of the larger kind of destination of history, I guess, or fake history.
Why do you think people, and especially young people, are just so wowed or so mesmerized by fantasy novels?
Well, I can tell you about me and why I was as a kid. I happened upon a copy of Bullfinch's Mythology in a college library when I was about 7 or 8, and I just was mesmerized by the myth. And I think part of the reason why fantasy is so compelling is the possibility, and also the idea that things outside of this sort of normal world that one lives in are possible. And also I think it's because the world that we live in feels magical to a kid. And I think it's useful to try to hold on to that sense of possibility as much as possible. And so when these strange things happen, part of me, as a kid, what I would say, I knew that that's the way it was. You know, even those sort of the things that happen with adults behind doors, or suddenly there's food in the refrigerator, right? Or like these little tiny things, even. Also, too, the thing about fantasy that I really, really like is the size of the stakes. Well done fantasy for me generally has huge life or death implications, and not just for our main characters, but generally for, you know, society or the world or whatever. There's a sort of a Shakespearean scope to it, right? That I think is really truly compelling, because the things that the characters do, the levers that they pull, have these massive, massive repercussions. And also it allows people to do things that are not simply every day. And I think that there's certainly in stories of our world and the brass tacks of humanity, right? There's something to stories that are like that. But I've always been just drawn to these ones that fire the imagination.
Yeah, I think we want things to happen that are unusual. And they don't very often happen in our lives. So maybe that's why we read about them.
Yeah. And also it's that creative fire, I think. New ideas come from using your imagination, right? And I think especially for kids, being exposed to possibility is never a bad thing.
So each of the chapters in both of the books opens with a quote of some kind. Did you make all that up?
Yes.
That was part of your creative writing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, indeed. One of the things about books like this that's that can be challenging is helping the reader find a way in to sort of wrap themselves in the world, because it's not a familiar one, right? And so having those quotations, which are sometimes from characters in the story, and sometimes from, you know, advertisements, and sometimes from old songs, or sometimes from minutes of meetings that happened hundreds of years ago, creating that sort of tapestry, I feel like, allows for you to think, oh yeah, well maybe these things did happen. I've been asked several times whether they're actual quotations. In the second book, there are three, two by Voltaire and one by Alexis de Tocqueville, right, who wrote about democracy in America, that are pretty much verbatim except for just a couple of words. But besides that, no, they're all just out of my brain.
That's what I thought. And that was part of the fun of the book, is that you were creating philosophers and plays and all kinds of other imaginary things along with the plot. So you were creating the culture and showing us bits and pieces of the culture.
Yeah. For me, that was really important to try to do that, because I'm a total fantasy and science fiction nerd. I mean, I have been ever since I was a kid. I still play a version of Dungeons and Dragons that I created with a friend of mine, right? And one of the things that I think is really important about magic is that if it's in the world, then it needs to be in the world. If people are using magic, they're not just going to use it from a tower. They're going to use it to bake bread and you know, forge steel in a better way and make architecture and make magic steamships and things like that. And it's also going to affect culture, like you were saying. So the church is a very different thing in this colonial America, because there are people walking around who actually make miracles. And that's going to change things slightly.
You just mentioned playing games, and your bio says that in addition to all these other things you do, including writing, you're a game designer.
That's right. I am in a partnership with an evolutionary biologist, actually, who teaches here at MSU. His name is Chris Organ. And we have a game called Epic Role Playing that is essentially a sort of a riff off of the kind of paper and pencil role-playing games that are like Dungeons and Dragons, which... if you don't know what that is, it's essentially a whole bunch of nerds sitting around together pretending to be elves and telling stories to each other, right? Using dice and some and making up adventures together with each other. I've always loved it because it's a very, very social thing. It's not sitting in a room by yourself, looking at a screen, making your thumbs ache. And by that, I mean like using a controller and getting, you know, carpal tunnel. You tell stories with each other. It's kind of rules for doing that.
So this was kind of a natural progression for you to go from game designing to writing books.
Oh, absolutely. The alchemy is based on actually a magic that we use in our game. So there's been a progression for me for most of my actually professional life, I guess. It's been telling stories. I started out in the theater and then started doing game design, and then eventually got to the books.
Well, amid all the adventures and thrills in these novels are the decisions that Ruby has to make, as you mentioned when we first started to talk. Can you say something about some of those decisions that she comes up against and what her choices are without giving away the mysteries in the book?
Yeah, I think so. Because at its heart, I mean, we've been talking a lot about the bells and whistles of the world and what I think of at least is the coolnesses of it. But there's a story that's at the heart of this series that's about this girl who is choosing who she is going to be. And that involves, yeah, not to give away too much of the plot, she has to choose oftentimes between her own safety and the safety of others. She has to choose between things that will put other people at risk. She has to choose between what she thinks of as moral actions and what she thinks of as maybe not necessarily moral actions, right? She has to choose between happiness and duty. She has to decide what honor means. She has to decide actually when to reveal her vulnerabilities, right? So they're questions that I think are part of growing up. And so, yeah, I really try to make these books not just a kind of a thrill ride, but really a sort of an idea of a reflection of the really hard things that kids need to decide to turn themselves into, larger kids, I guess.
And then how to deal with the consequences when you make the wrong choice.
Yeah. How to deal with the consequences when you make the wrong choice. And also that's how we learn, right? We learn through failure. We learn through making mistakes. And I teach at Montana State in the Honors College. And a lot of my students, when they arrive at university, having gone through middle school and high school and all that, they're terrified of doing something wrong. And I think that that's really, really an incredibly important thing to try to head off, if that's where we are in our sort of society. Because because personally, I think the only way that we grow is by messing up.
I'm just going to pop in for a moment to remind people that I'm Cherie Newman talking with Kent Davis about the first two books in his YA series titled A Riddle in Ruby, and this is The Right Question. Find us online at mtpr.org.
I think these books are great for girls. There's a girl in the middle of it, but they're also great for boys because it's a story about growing into yourself, not necessarily about growing into a particular way that somebody else thinks about you. and also, I think those questions, those big questions that are involved in adventures, are some of the most important ones that we have. They're just placed in a way that they're a little bit more exciting to consider, I guess. And I think these are books for age 10 to 100.
Oh, I liked them. I'm approaching 100.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm on my way.
I love all the cross-dressing. There's so much cross-dressing in here. It was hard to tell who was what.
Yeah, well, I did grow up in the theater, so.
Very Shakespearean, but also in the 1700s, if you're a girl or a woman, mm-hmm. How else are you going to get to have a life of adventure? You've got to present yourself as a man.
Yeah, exactly. And we still struggle with some of that stuff today, too.
Yeah. So. One more question.
Okay.
When will we see book 3?
Hopefully this fall. They've come out once a year so far, so.
Yay. Kent Davis lives in Bozeman, Montana. Look for more information about him and his books and sign up for our podcast at mtpr.org. Also there, children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting The Right Question since 2008. And thanks to you for listening and for your financial contribution. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you piles of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.